got 28 more seconds to go, and I can use those up very quickly. But we're concerned about total transparency, total accountability, and if an officer is fired for just cause, that officer remains fired and not then returned. I think later in the evening, this afternoon, you will be considering something around the IPR and when discipline is different, and then whether the chief then reports to the commission or write that. We're concerned that that is not just written inside of something that only the officer sees. Finally, we want to urge the council to note and look at this contract very carefully and see if it's really in the best interest and in the forward motion of addressing the issues of the DOJ findings and not allow the CBA to hold changes hostage and work towards a more transformative and transparent Portland Police Bureau and a collective bargaining agreement, and one that does not hold the DOJ's settlement agreement hostage to the signing of a CBA and an MOU. Thank you.
Let me ask, I know you're going to speak as a panel perhaps, but let me ask you a particular question just to follow up on one of your points there to make sure I understand it, and that is with respect to the discipline guide, there's been a regrettable series of incidents in which the police chief and the police commissioner made a discipline decision and it was overturned in arbitration. Do you believe that this discipline guide gives us a stronger position in that dynamic?
I have to answer that of both a yes and a no. Yes, it will give a guide in that we will see what will be the discipline issues, and then a no, because currently we see that things when discipline has been recommended, in one particular case that we will bring up, the chief has decided that he would do something totally different. And I bring up again the case that you've heard me talk about, which is in dealing with Officer Wyatt, a man who could not keep his hands off of women, a man who we sent to class three times to understand what sexual harassment is. He still could not keep his hands off of women. And then instead of him being fired, he is demoted, and then he is promoted in being in charge of the very department that is to take care of victims who are a part of sexual harassment. That doesn't make any sense. So that's the no part of the discipline piece. It's not going to stick tight. I hope I'm proved wrong, but so far at this point, I have not.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Dr. Bethel, I'm going to check on the exact language. My understanding was on the steroid use that if the substance, the over-the-counter substance, is found occurring steroids, they're not allowed to keep taking it. That they have to stop taking it, but because they didn't know about it, that it would not automatically result in firing.
Yeah, I noted that too.
So I'm going to check on that language.
Yes, I understand that it doesn't automatically result in firing, but
they don't get to keep taking
it. I missed that piece about they can no longer use it, then I want to be corrected.
If Dr. Bethel, we're going to have all the testimony, then come back with our laundry list. But my understanding is once you are on notice that a product has a steroid, you don't get to take it again and claim that you didn't know. So there might be another product that you could claim ignorance of. But once it's been determined that there's a steroid in that over-the-counter product, you would not be able to take it again. And as to your question about whether we've somehow locked the city in on the question of whether the 48-hour rule is now a mandatory or permissive subject of bargaining, we'll bring the team back to answer that one as well after the testimony. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. I'm Shauna Kerfee. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild Portland chapter. I'm also legal counsel for the AMA Coalition, but I'm not speaking in that capacity today. The NLG, as an organization, is a strong supporter of the rights of workers to organize and to collectively bargain for better wages and working conditions. The NLG also appreciates that the ordinance at issue here today resolves part of the PPA's opposition to the settlement agreement in the lawsuit brought by the Department of Justice against the city and moves that case forward to a fairness hearing where the public may weigh in on the agreement before the court. The NLG, however, finds it deeply troubling that the collective bargaining process was tied to the PPA's opposition to the settlement agreement, and as a result, important public policy decisions took place behind closed doors. Moreover, the CBA overall appears to make several important concessions to the PPA without corresponding gains in police accountability. I'm going to focus on three. The 48-hour rule, as I'm sure you know, is a huge issue. IPR's ability to conduct independent investigations and IPR's authority to conduct investigations of deadly force incidents. First, the 48-hour rule, as you've already heard from Dr. Bethel, is a huge concern for the community. As the NLG outlined in its memo to City Council, decisions by the Employment Relations Board indicate notices like the 48-hour rule are not mandatory subjects of bargaining. This means the city, in its negotiations, chose to keep it on the table instead of making a public stand for accountability. I recognize there are exceptions to the rule, as the chief discussed, including that it does not apply when criminal culpability is at issue or if delay will jeopardize the investigation. These exceptions beg the question of why have the rule at all, especially considering how it erodes public trust and police oversight, and ultimately in the Bureau itself. Moreover, the MOA that resolves the PPA's opposition to the settlement agreement reserves the PPA's right to grieve issues related to obtaining officer statements and investigation, and thus leaves uncertainty about this important issue. Second, IPR's ability to conduct independent investigations, which I know you will address later today, and there will be a different member of the NLG to speak to you then. The CBA still implies that a Bureau member will interview officers or conduct investigations, as it states that interviewees will be informed of the name, rank, and command of the officer in charge of the investigation and the interviewing officer. This lack of clarity is troubling because, again, the PPA has reserved the right to grieve the city's implementation of the settlement agreement as it relates to officers' statements and investigations. Third, IPR's ability to conduct investigations of deadly force incidents. The CPA states that IPR has no authority regarding Article 61.7, which in turn refers to an officer's right to counsel and union representation in deadly force incidents. The CBA is thus unclear with regard to whether the IPR has no authority to investigate deadly force incidents or merely has no authority over officers' right to representation. Deadly force incidents, as you know, however, are the most serious instances of potential police misconduct and therefore merit the highest degree of public oversight and accountability. In conclusion, the public expects and deserves an oversight system that is credible, effective, and just. The CPA does not get us there. I want you to consider Dan's suggestion, who will speak to you next, that the MOA and the CBA can be separated so the suit can move forward, the DOJ suit, can move forward without binding the city to the CBA before the public gets to speak to the court on the fairness of the settlement agreement. Now, I know that you've been told that this is the last best offer. And I want to remind you that collective bargaining is not a force of nature. It's a choice. It's a choice reflected by the parties that sat at that table. And it's your choice here today to choose to ratify the CBA. Thank you.
Counsel, can I just ask you, since we have the benefit of you being a lawyer on the panel, is it your opinion that in not addressing the 48-hour rule that we have somehow conceded it's a mandatory subject of bargaining, or do you believe that then is still an issue that could be decided by a higher tribunal?
I think that's still an issue. I think you missed an opportunity by negotiating it.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's an important distinction.
Right.
Another question on the subject of the timing of these interviews, 48 hours or whenever. The ACLU said last year if the Bureau requires a mandatory on-scene interview, it may foreclose the possibility of criminal prosecution. And while the Bureau and the city may decide that this risk is outweighed by the value of having accurate information in a timely manner, they should make this decision intentionally. You don't think that the chief still has that prerogative?
It's my understanding that if there's criminal culpability is a potential issue, the 48-hour rule does not apply. It's not, that's what it says in the CBA. So the Garrity concern, which I think is what you're raising, is not tied to the 48-hour rule. To the extent that the rule does not apply when criminal culpability is at issue, and Garrity only applies when criminal culpability is at issue.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Dan, you may want to address the same questions, but please.
I'll probably will. Hi, I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Wash. I'm also a steering committee member of the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, Mayor Hales and commissioners. Even though we are concerned about the broad potential challenges to the policy it allows, we understand if the city signs the Portland Police Association's Memorandum of Understanding regarding the DOJ agreement today. This will allow the federal judge to enter the agreement into the record this Thursday and set a fairness hearing to decide whether the agreement resolves the problems identified by the DOJ's investigations into the Portland Police use of force. However, community testimony at that fairness hearing, expected to be held sometime in February, could prompt the judge to order changes to the DOJ agreement that better fix Portland's troubled oversight system and clarify issues around use of force. Because the CBA could be affected by those decisions and because the judge should not be influenced in his decision by facts on the ground created by signing the new contract ahead of the agreement's ratification, the city should delay voting on the CBA until after the fairness hearing. We want to be clear that our organization works regularly and supports labor unions and the right to bargain for fair working conditions and wages and benefits. The PPA is an association of police officers who are sometimes called out to squash the demonstrations of other workers. They use their considerable power to prevent accountability for use of excessive and deadly force, to avoid being investigated by anybody outside of law enforcement. We would be equally as alarmed if the Portland Teachers Association were going beyond asking for reasonable classroom sizes, which directly affects their workload, and instead ask for a right to institute corporal punishment against students with limited to outside review of their actions. The PPA contract was negotiated mostly behind closed doors. There were three public meetings, all of which I attended, and only two of which the PPA attended. The council is our elected leadership, and we expect more from the city in clearing the way for timely and independent investigations. However, the city chose to leave in the so-called 48-hour rules and parts of the contract which could be interpreted to limit IPR from investigating misconduct, including deadly force cases. It's also of great concern that the newly reinstituted performance reviews will not include all complaints against officers, only ones that are sustained, and will not be used for transfer, discipline, or promotion. If an officer has a pattern of receiving certain kinds of complaints, don't you think their supervisor should mention that in the annual review? We also had hoped the city would expand drug testing introduced in 2011 to include mandatory tests after deadly excessive force incidents, but that did not happen. We signed on to the letter the National Lawyers Guild sent you earlier this month, pointing out that there's nothing mandating the city has to bargain around 48-hour rule or the ability to compel officer testimony. You could have struck those parts of the agreement and said, sorry, it's not mandatory, but you didn't do that. Getting back to the DOJ agreement, we earlier raised concerns that administrative investigations are mandated only when an officer is found to have violated somebody's rights at civil trial, rather than also when a judgment or settlement are entered. The fact that PPA is asserting its due process rights over this piece, which affects very few officers since few lawsuits result in jury verdicts, underscores this as one of the reasons we're hoping the DOJ agreement gets modified after the fairness hearing. And just the tying together of these two issues, if this is so intertwined and this is a global settlement, then this was part of the DOJ agreement and the AMA coalition should have been involved in the negotiations, and I believe we were not involved. So,
Dan, I haven't heard that argument before you just raised about the performance reviews. I wanted to give you just a chance to flush out the point you just made. So you've just suggested to us that rather than base the performance review on sustained complaints, that we give the supervising authority the a power to base it in part on complaints that haven't been sustained, which I think to lawyers and to people concerned with workers' rights raises some issues about fairness. So what's the analogy you would have in any other workplace setting where a mere complaint that hasn't been founded in fact could lead to a negative performance evaluation without potentially a recourse by the employee? And since you raised it, why do you believe that would be fair?
Well, I didn't say there's no recourse. There's recourse built into the fairness to the agreement about the performance reviews, but the issue is that there's some officers who get the same kinds of complaints over and over again, and they're either not sustained in the sense that they're exonerated and found within policy, or they're not sustained because there wasn't enough evidence one way or the other, and it was he said, she said, and believe me, I know that's a lot of the cases because it's just the officer and the person, which doesn't mean that it didn't happen. And it doesn't mean the officer isn't having behavioral issues. So having a stack of unsustained allegations against you doesn't mean that your performance is spotless.
I appreciate the point, but I just want to put up a caution flag here because we all, regardless of how we view the outcome here, we believe in some basic tenets of fairness. And if it's not sustained or it doesn't have adequate evidence behind it or whatever, to in the through the back door say that it has weight in determining performance evaluations, to me strikes is a slippery slope. But I just want to flag a concern because now you're talking about something which has not been sustained, but could be the basis of a negative performance evaluation, which could have implications for your future advancement within the department.
As I understand it, the performance evaluations do not lead to discipline in any way. And what I think Dan is trying to get at, he wants to capture a situation where it looks like there's a problem with this officer. And actually, I'm not talking about public employers, but in the private setting, there you will put a note in the file if you get a complaint. Anyway, there's different rights for public employees. But I think what Dan is saying is if it looks like there's a pattern based on complaints that are not that are where the officer has not been exonerated, what harm is it to consider that in the performance evaluation if the evaluation isn't used for officer discipline? As I understand, it's not used for officer discipline.
Not in and of itself.
Not in and of itself, but it is part of the record that could be used for things like considering promotions in the future. We're certainly, hopefully not going to disregard a negative series of performance evaluations in light of future. It strikes me that it's a I understand where he's going. I just have some concerns about the fairness of operating off of a mere complaint. And in the private sector, we find that complaints are often directed to people based on invidious classifications. And I would hate to see the black employee or the gay employee that's getting complaints because of some disparate treatment to have that influence his or her employment evaluation. So I just think we should tread lightly.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next three are Casey Jama, Joanne Hardesty, and Joe Walsh.
It's old home week, yes.
Good morning.
Good afternoon, Mayor, City Council members. For the record, I'm Joanne Hardesty. I am on the steering committee of the Albana Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice in Police Reform. It's amazing how we get that name mixed up a lot. I want to thank you first for some of the changes that were made to the Portland Police Association's contract. I appreciate you doing away with the fake fitness bonus. So that we're no longer paying people to have their fingers pricked and their blood pressure taken. So I appreciate that disappearing in these contract talks this time. I appreciate that the performance evaluation actually has a little more clarity than the last collective bargaining contract that this body passed. However, I'm concerned that the performance evaluation is not going to be used to determine someone's fitness for a particular assignment. I think it's ludicrous to evaluate someone and then not be able to determine whether or not this is a police officer that should be either whether it's the mental health unit, whether this is the ideal person to work with people with mental health issues, whether this is the appropriate person to work with gang youth, whether this is the appropriate police officer to be an emissary out in the community working with community organizations. So if you're not going to use a performance evaluation to determine whether or not you have an effective employee, then I have to ask you, why the heck would you do a performance evaluation? Most employers use those to determine assignments, to determine special assignments, to determine whether or not the employee is matched to the right work assignment. And so to say that the performance evaluation won't impact someone's pay, their assignment, et cetera, seems to be a bit ludicrous. When I hear Daryl Turner say that the discipline matrix will be an advisory tool for the police commissioner and the police chief to use, that again makes my blood boil, because the reason we need a discipline matrix is because there is no certainty either in the public or in the police bureau about what appropriate sanctions are for certain activity. And so if we're developing a discipline matrix simply as an advisory tool rather than something that will give certainty to police officers and the public, I think that's a mistake. I will also, for the record, say that our missed opportunity once again as it relates to taking the 48-hour rule has already been spoke about, but I want to put on the record that the performance evaluations, the 48-hour rules, have been consistent problems when it comes to trying to hold police accountable for inappropriate behavior. They've been consistent problems that we had the opportunity to fix, and we chose to just say, well, it's going to be a problem, so we won't deal with that. My fear is that in a settlement agreement, what you will do today will prevent Judge Simon from actually making significant changes, because he will not want to make any proposed changes to the settlement agreement that would impact the collective bargaining agreement. So basically, you put us back in the same box we've been in. And through your actions today with this vote, you basically put us right back where we've been. And the community hears over and over again, we can't discipline officers because of the collective bargaining agreement. Well, guess what? We had the chance to fix the collective bargaining agreement significantly this time, and you've chose not to do that. I'm done.
Joanne, didn't Judge Simon, we'll pose this question later, but didn't Judge Simon make it fairly clear throughout the proceeding that as the federal authority on this, his view of the law trumps whatever we do?
No. I think what he made clear was that he would not interfere with a collective bargaining agreement. He cannot interfere with a collective bargaining agreement. So you voting on this agreement today, so when the public comes to the community fairness hearing and talks about, the public doesn't have 48 hours before we can give a statement, so why should the police have 48 hours? Even the Department of Justice brought that up in their investigation. When we take that to Judge Simon, Judge Simon will say, well, the Portland City Council just voted a new four-year contract, so clearly they didn't see the 48-hour rule as an issue, right? Well, the community's been saying this for well over a decade.
So I'm going to put this to the attorneys later, but I think we're missing each other in that conversation, because I do believe under the Supremacy Clause he has the authority to trump us, but we'll ask the team that follows.
Yes, I had the impression that he did not want to do anything to impact the collective bargaining agreement, which is why he sent us to mediation. So when you vote this in, that becomes what we have to live with for the next 4 years.
Thank you. Casey. Good afternoon, Mayor Hellis and Chair Commissioners. My name is Casey Chama. I am the Executive Director of the Center for Intercultural Organizing. First of all, before I start my comments, I want to let you know that both my organization and myself absolutely supports our union's collective bargaining in general concept. But in terms of this case of the Portland Police Union, I have been around this issue for a while, and it's been becoming clear that it's been used as a tool to derail community policing and community police accountability. And so for that sense, today, my issues, particularly since it has been this issue, is very, very complex one. It focuses on the paragraph 9 that the city attorney presented to us, particularly as it relates to the 48 rule and as it relates to the IPR review that we will be foreseeing today. And those two issues, for me, it's simple. One is that, as I understand now, just what I heard before when the chief was here, that even the 48-hour rule, the chief might have a potential to be used as a tool if he wants to. And my understanding is that we have to be very clear. If we have to not be attached in this issue, as the folks from EMA and the attorney said, that we should not be attaching the 40-hour rule to the CBA, and we should be separating, and the city should not be forgiving that aspect of it and separating as a collective bargaining issue. That allows us then to move forward. The second piece that I want to address is that I think IPR if we really truly wanted to have an IPR, independent police review, I think we should have one. And the proposal that right now in front of us that been attached to the collective bargaining is very much not allowing to have that independent police review. And I really believe that we should not be accepting this contract today as a good faith. Time and time it seems to be it's happening that even if issues that Joanne Harris raised there for the disciplinary issues, that as even use now the chief has actually might be able to use as a potential tool. That is sort of, to me, again, that is the heart of what's wrong with the system. Whereas collectively, each time, we're asking the Portland police to police itself.
Right.
And I think it's a time for us as a community that we have to stop for a minute and step back and realize that we want to support our police union, a police force. We want to make sure that they do their job well. But that at the meantime, they are the one who has the guns. And if we have to hold higher standards because of that. And for that reason, we have to give every humble opportunity to community to believe that their police union, police force are accountable. So in conclusion, that I will urge you today to not to accept this MOU and not to accept the collective bargaining agreement that the city struck with the Portland Police Associations. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Joe, good afternoon.
My name is Joe Walsh. I represent Individuals for Justice. And some of you know that when I was working for a living, I was a chief union steward for the IBEW. And I did negotiate contracts, and I did negotiate working conditions. I did negotiate with management about what the rights of management are versus what the rights of the union is. So I'm familiar with a lot of this stuff. If I negotiated this contract and I got it signed off by the council, I would have all my friends in the union buying me drinks for weeks. This is a very pro-union contract. What you have is a question about the 48 hours that everybody in the community that I talk to has great concern, and they don't believe that if a police officer shoots somebody, that he doesn't have to talk to anybody for 48 hours. Most people don't understand that. The drug testing that you're introducing now and saying, well, you know, if we pick up steroids and you bring in the commercial energy drink and show us that it contains steroids, we'll give you a letter of reprimand instead of firing you. That's a little bit insane.
Joe,
if there's any...
Joe, in fairness, that's not actually what it says. Just if you bring in that 48-hour drink or 24-hour drink and you establish that that is the source...
48-hour drink?
Whatever it is. Let's say you have something you bring in and you say, this is what I consumed.
All right, let's start at the beginning.
And it doesn't
start at the beginning. You get tested for drugs.
Right.
And it shows up positive.
Right.
Go from there.
The only exception that is built into this drug policy is if you can establish that you unknowingly consumed the steroid, i.e., you can produce something you consume where the steroid is not marked on the ingredients. A lab test establishes that it has a steroid, and you can show that you, through no fault of your own, you consumed it. That's the only exception that's been created here, and that's different
okay.
than knowingly consuming
it. But you also had testimony that you've done, and I would like some of my time back. You also have testimony that you have some of your testing. You've done thousands of testing, and nothing has shown up. So why is the union so concerned about this exception coming in? If there's no indication that any of the officers are using steroids, did I miss that? It seems to me that that was the testimony. Thousands of tests, and all negative. Why are they so concerned about this one exception? And why did your negotiators let it go? Now, my last point, just going to say this. The process here is very difficult for the public. You have all of your negotiators. You have all the unions here. You have more guns in this room. If we could sell them, we'd all be rich. And you bring in the public to testify at this point. For you to overturn this contract, you would have to kick in the teeth your negotiators. You would have to say, you did a bum job. And you guys don't do that. You keep complimenting each other so much, it makes me very confused. You bring this in at the wrong time. You lock us out, and you do the negotiations behind closed doors. You don't allow people to come into a process at the middle or the beginning. And as Dan Haldeman testified, he went to three, and the union didn't bother showing up because they don't want it in the public. They want it private. And on their property, they made it private, if that's my understanding. So I have a great deal of trouble with this whole process. You bring us in at the wrong time. The chances of you not voting for this is zilch, nada. You will vote for this. You may give some little gift to all of us here, but you're going to put this into effect. And we're going to go before the judge in February handicapped again.
Okay, thank you.
The next three are Kathy Bushman, Mark J. Hoffhines Jr., and Barry Joe Stull.
Carla, how many people total signed up?
There was nine on that 1190, and I've got four on 1191.
One, probably, or not sooner.
Mayor, just before we take more testimony, because we're going to have a lot more testimony than deliberation, then we have to decide, and then we're at some point going to get to the regular agenda, and so just because we have city staff that's on call, do you have any?
Yeah, it's my intention that we would go till one and then break for an hour.
Break for an hour and then pick up whatever's left on the regular agenda.
Pick up whatever's left and then take up the afternoon agenda after that. Does that make sense to everybody?
Can I assume that would include 1208?
It would include everything after 1205. Yes, it would.
Okay, so I'll just. I don't want people on.
Yeah, I think there's
on call.
Slim chance we will get to the regular agenda before this afternoon at 2 o'clock. I mean,
Commissioner.
Well, since I recognize that some people's parking meters may be challenged, I just wanted to let folks know that my staff has been looking into the issue of what's in the contract versus what's in the policy, and the new regulations on steroid substances are in the policy rather than the contract. So I think that we're both correct, Dr. Bethel, that it's not. And so we're getting clarification on the changes in the policy as well.
Great, thank you. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, Mark J. Alphines, Jr. with UCARE. Hey, so I only have 2 points. First point is we don't get 48 hours, nor should they. Second point is that I think the worst statement made today was that we have talked about how to use it, but not that we are going to use it. That was the worst statement made today. And so I think that needed to be addressed and thought about, because just because it's going to be on the books doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to use it. That was the exact statement that they said. And so with that clarification, I'll let you guys figure out what you're going to do.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Afternoon.
Barry Joe Stull. I hate to have to correct Mr. Walsh, who loaned me this pen, but we're handicapped still. This is an ongoing environment here in the city of Portland, and I don't know what I can do to change it. At the end of the last century, in the year 2000, I was a Pacific Green Party candidate, and if you could manage to get through all the booking photos on an internet search of my name, you would find out that I was a Pacific Green Party candidate, and the quotes on that page include, "Stull's not a career politician posturing for your vote. He fearlessly tackles government and racist police corruption head on." Well, since then, I have this scar on my head. I got that as an alum at Lewis and Clark College, where the campus safety intentionally scoured my head on the paving stones, knowing I was an alum, knowing I was a person with a disability, and most importantly, knowing that in this environment, they were not going to be held accountable by this corrupt government. That being said, had a knock on my door, September 1st, 2003. I was protected under the Medical Marijuana Act. My neurologist had advanced degrees in neurology and neurophysiology. He taught neurology at the OHSU Medical School. Jury never got to hear his testimony. What was the problem? The problem was the police officer put in his police report the subject of Stephen Dons, who died in custody at the Multnomah County Detention Center here across the park, after a shootout with the Portland police. I think it was friendly fire. I think Officer Colleen Weibel was actually shot by another Portland police officer. And I thought I had to pay for it, because not only did Officer Seri put that he thought I had inside information, I do have informants, but that he fatally shot and killed James Jahar Perez, an unarmed black motorist, 30 seconds after they pulled him over. Now, I was supposed to have my pot trial on April 20th, 2004, but I couldn't that day because of a court scheduling error that somehow bumped my trial so that they could instead have District Attorney Michael Schrunk chairing the coroner's inquest into the fatal shooting of James Jahar Perez. Fearlessly tackled government and racist police corruption head on. That's what I said before I picked up this bogus felony conviction when I was protected under the Medical Marijuana Act that I worked decades to effect. I don't know how we're going to change until you change. I really don't know how we are all going to change until you five change. Thank you.
For item 1191, we have Dan Handelman, Joe Walsh, and Mark J. Hoffhines, Jr.
They've already testified, so.
Okay.
So and anybody else who hasn't testified?
That's all on the list. Everybody else testified.
Okay. I think there's some questions for staff. So I think we certainly need Anna, and then David's going to go get Ellen. And then we may need Police Bureau as well, but who's on first with a question for Anna, if we have any? I think there are a number of questions for Ellen, maybe none for you, Anna, but we'll see.
Well, I had asked Anna yesterday about the 48 hours, and could you just recap what the reasons are for why we didn't address that?
Certainly. When in terms of the collective bargaining, one of the things that I guess there's a couple things. One, with the 48-hour rule, while the city does think some of that language is permissive, we also understand from the advice of our city attorneys that the Employment Relations Board may look at this as mandatory, particularly when you're talking about use of force, and that could be treated differently. But what the parties believe about a particular subject for bargaining, whether it's permissive or mandatory, is not the end of that discussion. Because if there is disagreement, either party has the opportunity to go to the Employment Relations Board and have the board resolve that issue. Again, that would have resulted in a lengthy hearing. We know because that board is underfunded. The cases we have before them take anywhere. Again, I don't think we've had a case heard in less than 4 months. We've had cases waiting out there for as long as a year. Again, not the fault of the Employment Relations Board, but this is a very lengthy process. The likelihood of it coming, a decision being, well, in some cases, it's probably there are mandatory impacts to this, so it isn't a clear-cut issue of you simply take it out of the contract and move on. The other parts is this is a very complicated issue in terms of allowing some period of time before an officer's interview is compelled. As the chief said, this doesn't prevent voluntary testimony, but there are a lot of complicated issues to this, and we believe some of these should be resolved through implementation of these reforms, once we have the COAB in place, once we have the compliance officer in place, these issues can be addressed as part of the larger discussion. But again, absent a mediated settlement, we don't have the same opportunities to do that.
So can we just address specifically Dr. Bethel's question? Because Dr. Bethel asked, I thought, a reasonable question that has something that we've done in the proposal before council tilted the playing field here in terms of whether it will later be construed or could be construed as mandatory or permissive. Is there something in the course of bargaining or what we're going to do that gives some advantage to either side on that question?
No, I appreciate that question, and I also thought it was a fair question and concern that Dr. Bethel raised. Certainly from our point of view, the answer is absolutely not. It's clear in the memorandum of agreement that the city and the PPA have a respectful disagreement about this issue, and in terms of the permissiveness of the bargaining, and so we've fully retained our rights with regard to that, and so from our perspective, the answer is absolutely not. We have not compromised. There's nothing in either the collective bargaining agreement or the MOA that would compromise our ability to argue in any forum that it's a permissive subject of bargaining.
So the way it's set out, if I understand correctly, is that the judge in the Department of Justice settlement agreement could say city and union go bargain this or take it to the employee relations board, and that by settling the contract except for the carve-outs, we are settling everything else but acknowledging that there may be some direction from the court to go do something else on those three carve-outs.
I would say that is a misunderstanding on the part of the advocates in terms of the ability of Judge Simon to actually rewrite the agreement. So at the fairness hearing, the community and interested members are going to have the opportunity to testify before Judge Simon about their concerns, objections, support for the proposed settlement agreement. And the decision before Judge Simon will be whether to accept or reject the settlement agreement. But the judge does not have the power to actually rewrite the settlement agreement. So, for example, the judge could not add a term to the settlement agreement that directed the city to renegotiate or get rid of certain contract terms. So the DOJ agreement must rise or fall as a whole, and the United
well, and
States...
His practical effect is if he threw it out and said we're going to trial, that in effect places pressure on the parties to do something if they want to avoid a protracted trial, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So he has indirect leverage even if he can't compel it.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
So I think Joanne stated it more accurately than I did, and that he doesn't have the power to compel a term, but he can, by saying we're going to go to trial, put pressure on the parties, in effect, to discuss or negotiate any particular issue.
Yes, I think that's right, and the only sort of nuance to that is that in the collaborative agreement that we negotiated with the AMA coalition, they agreed that they would advocate for the judge to enter the settlement agreement, but that they wanted to reserve their right to also advocate for further changes to the settlement agreement. So I don't believe that at least the written documents from the AMA coalition indicate that they do not want to advocate that Judge Simon reject the agreement.
So the carve-out means that we are agreeing to disagree on that one issue.
Yes.
The judge cannot direct us to cannot direct anybody to address that issue singly, that they can reject the whole thing, but they can't say go figure that out. We can, and this I guess is a question for Anna, we can open the contract again for bargaining on just that one issue, or no?
Yes. Yeah, we could talk to Portland Police Association about doing that. And my experience with the association is where there are issues that arise mid-contract that they have not taken the stance of we're not going to talk to you because we have a contract in place. They have been willing to talk and negotiate with the city over issues that arise that they believe are mandatory for bargaining.
Do both sides have to agree to open a contract to discuss a particular item?
Generally, yes, it really depends on the particular item. So, but if it's express language in the contract, yes.
Could I just follow up on that for a sec? And I'm not advocating this approach, but if we adopt this contract, if the contract's ratified, and at some point in the future, the police commissioner determines that there needs to be a change in the 48-hour rule and believes that it's a permissive subject of bargaining, then he or she would technically have the right to make that change, understanding that it could trigger a ULP and it would get decided. But if it's permissive, they technically could move a change midterm, correct?
Well, I would probably be more comfortable if one of the labor attorneys were going to address that completely. But, yeah, I think based on your question, certainly we could do that. And yes, there could be a ULP filed.
The difference being, instead of holding up the whole contract process, it could be decided in a different cycle with a contract in place.
Yes.
I'm not advocating that approach, but that is, if it's permissive, then we are claiming we have the right to make changes in policies, correct?
But just to be clear, I mean, the fact that because we've negotiated language, whether it's permissive or mandatory, it's still part of our collective bargaining agreement. So we can't unilaterally change something that's in that's expressly in the contract,
right. Okay.
Absent a negotiated agreement.
So we require a reopener?
Yes.
Just I think we should maybe take a second to look at the actual language of the so-called 48-hour rule, which is whenever delay in conducting the interview will not jeopardize the successful accomplishment of the investigation or when criminal culpability is not at issue, advance notice should be given not less than 48 hours. So actually, it's, I think, kind of up to the police chief and the police commissioner to determine whether delay will jeopardize the successful accomplishment of investigation. So it's not an absolute rule. It's something where there might be disputes between the chief and the commissioner and the union as to jeopardization. But there seems to be substantial possibility for the chief and the commissioner to say that the 48-hour rule should not apply.
That's my interpretation as well.
The only thing I would want to add, Commissioner Fritz, in response to your question is that in terms of the judge adding some sort of term that would say, you know, thou shalt get rid of the 48-hour rule in the contract, the judge wouldn't be able to do that. But I want to stress that the DOJ settlement agreement requires the city to develop protocols for on-scene investigations following post-critical incidents, to work with the district attorney and the community to come up with protocols about how the chief will exercise that discretion when it's important to immediately compel an interview, and that's a part of the settlement agreement that we must comply with. And the only thing that the Portland Police Association did was to reserve its right that if those changes were to implicate a mandatory subject of bargaining, that they wanted to retain their rights to that. But the conversation about when it's appropriate to immediately compel an officer to submit to an interview is a subject that I think, as Mayor Hales pointed out, the ACLU and others acknowledge it's a very complex decision that deserves and, frankly, needs widespread community input about how the city should proceed.
But that language that Commissioner Novick so helpfully just read would allow us that leeway, because the Community Advisory Board could develop guidelines for what that means as to when a delay might impede the investigation, and that would then be still within the guidelines of this contract.
Yes, I mean, I think it would be, you know, it would be remiss of me to say that, you know, I think the PPA has a different view, perhaps, of our ability. But yes, I mean, in terms of the city seeking advice about how they should exercise language under the contract, I think certainly that the COAB would be an appropriate body to weigh in on that.
Could I just follow up on that? Because one of the challenges that I've had is in reading and rereading Article 61, I think it's fair to say that the language that we're interpreting is not a model of clarity, the way it's structured.
It contains some double negatives, yes.
It contains some double negatives, which to me are not, if you read it, are not actually intended to be parallel double negatives. So, Steve quoted the first section, which is, when delay will not jeopardize the successful accomplishment of the investigation. So that, I think we can all understand what that means. But it goes on to say, or when criminal culpability is not at issue. Now, freely translated, I read that as when criminal culpability is not at issue because what? Which side of the ledger? Because someone believes that it is likely to be an issue or not an issue?
It's not an issue.
If
the commissioner determines that criminal culpability is not an issue, then they can compel an interview prior to 48 hours.
Exactly. It's actually, you know, when you can you continue reading this sentence, it's not actually what it says, because it then says you may give 24 hours notice. So it just, it's, but I think Commissioner Fritz's point is well taken, that it is written with conditions that can be interpreted. It is not an absolute, and that whether there's a disagreement between the parties, I don't know that we've ever tested the contours of that disagreement, because there are two conditions here which the decision maker can interpret. And sure, the other side to this is free to contest that, but it is conditioned. It is not absolute.
Yes, absolutely so.
Can I address a couple other issues that came up? Because you've heard a lot of conversation about the steroid issue. So to the point that was made by Joanne, if in all the testing no one's ever tested positive for steroids, why did we carve out this exception?
I think it's issue of a matter of fairness to, as you stated, Commissioner, when an officer unknowingly is ingesting a substance that contains an unlabeled steroid. We know that has occurred, not within our force, but that there have been instances of steroids that are not on the label showing up in over-the-counter supplements. So it's not beyond the scope that it could happen. But the issue that if it's not a problem, why don't you carve it out? I mean, we have shown that we don't have a problem with drug use either based on the tests we've done, yet we are going to continue to have this policy in place where we conduct random drug testing, where we conduct reasonable suspicion testing. So it's really just a matter of fairness, and the city can't be dictating what a person does, a police officer does, that's lawful in their own time. We don't have that authority.
Do you view this as a major loophole in our law, or simply as a fairness carve out that once it's been determined that that substance has a steroid, you cannot use again?
It's a fairness issue. It's not a major loophole. The policy, and yes, it's not in the contract, but it is a binding negotiated policy. So it's every bit as enforceable as a contract provision would be. Explicitly states the employee has to stop taking the supplement, and it doesn't state that the employee gets a free ride and there'll be no discipline. It doesn't even guarantee there won't be termination. What it does carve out is if an officer is found guilty of, test positive for another illegal drug, cocaine or something, it's automatic termination. And in this particular case, it is not automatic.
The other issue that...
Before you move on from that, excuse me, Commissioner, my staff have been able to find that policy language. So if you could, before the end of this afternoon's hearings, get that to me, I would appreciate it. Just knowing we had some confusion over the fitness rules in the last contract, I'd really like to see that language.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it does state in Section D, Section D1, the employee shall stop taking the supplement, and I will provide that to you.
Thank you.
The Dr. Bethel and Dan Handelman, at least, and maybe others, also raised some interesting issues about performance evaluations, and I'd like to be able to just get a little more clarity.
Yeah, so, I was going to ask the chief to come up on that point as well.
Maybe, so, chief, if you could come forward. I think there's a couple of different issues that have been raised. One of them is, which I'll state not in the negative, but the positive. Once you've done a performance review under the proposed agreement before us, what can you do with that performance review? So let's take an example of a performance review that says someone is a poor performer. What under this agreement can you do with that in terms of future actions involving that officer?
Well, and I might try to broaden that question a bit and get them to answer it both ways maybe, and that is, so describe, not just for our benefit, but for anybody that might be paying attention, in the new order that will be created by these agreements and the discipline guide and the other things that you're changing in the Bureau, what's a performance review for? How does discipline happen, and how does somebody get a promotion, and where do they connect? I mean, I realize that's a big subject. But
that is a big subject.
But I mean, in general terms, you know, how is someone evaluated in a performance evaluation, and what happens to that information? What bearing does it have on their work?
What's going to inform the supervisor of how they're doing as an employee, and inform the employee of their supervisor's thoughts on their work performance, and guide the employee in future performance issues? If we have performance deficiencies identified, then the next step in that process, if they're minor deficiencies, would be potentially a work plan where you're documenting what those deficiencies are and how to correct them and a timeline for doing so. Certainly, if you have misconduct that you're identifying, or the performance rises to such a level that it's a violation of policy, then we're going to do an investigation into that poor performance, and it will result in discipline.
So a performance evaluation could, therefore,
it's going to inform the supervisor and the employee.
Right.
So how would the public know about an instance where an employee repeatedly gets poor evaluations, poor performance evaluations, but subsequently at some point gets a promotion or a transfer to a higher-rated job? How would either the public or this body know that in spite of negative performance evaluations, someone's been promoted?
I'm not sure that those would be made public. Like most of our personnel decisions, they are expected to be kept confidential. When we have, I believe in redemption, and employees are provided the opportunity to do better. So at some point in that evaluation process, the employees put on notice if there are issues. They're given a plan of correction or assistance, and employees can move forward. If you have repeated behavior, then I would expect it to be to result in a different process. So if year after year the same employee is having performance issues, then that's going to result in a different process. And if it doesn't, then we hold the supervisor accountable.
So, Chief, just to put a finer point on it, under our form of government, you report to the commissioner in charge, who in this instance is the mayor.
Yes, sir.
So if you come to the mayor with a request that he authorize a promotion, under this system, the mayor routinely can say, I'd like to know a little bit about this person's performance. And that would include how have they been evaluated, what's been their record, to the extent deficiencies have been identified, what steps have you taken or the supervisor. So that would all be within his purview to inquire.
Correct. And we have those conversations now.
Yeah, that's not a hypothetical. That's actually how it works.
Well, except you'd now have a...
We're
adding another tool. But so you're saying that the safety valve here is that the decision maker will have access to this information. So it would have to, for someone who is a chronic poor performer to get a promotion under this system, somehow it would have to slip through the supervisor, you, and then ultimately the accountable party, which is the commissioner in charge. But they would all have access to that information?
Well, and part of our promotional process is, I think to the mayor's point, is that the division commander comes into the chief's office and presents on the employee's performance, and it includes commendations, it includes any discipline issues and performance issues, and makes a recommendation as to whether or not that employee should be promoted.
Yeah, and again, we have been through this very discussion on real people and the question of real promotions, and that is how it works. So that comprehensive record is in front of me and in front of the chief when that decision is being made, and the buck stops with us as to whether it was a good decision or not. Other questions for this team, other points that we haven't clarified from testimony? I did want to get that clarified about both the steroids and the performance reviews, so thank you. Anything else? Great.
Just two things. One, I want to make it, I think it should be clear that voters for the Police Hall of Fame may take even inadvertent steroid use into account in making their decisions, and nothing we do today will affect that. And also, I'd assume that the only circumstance in which you would promote somebody by bad performance reviews is if they were a maverick who broke the rules but got results and at some point took down Al Capone, consistent with popular culture.
Well, actually, and again, it's not hypothetical. The chief said he believes in redemption. We've certainly seen situations where employees underperformed in the past, then over a lengthy period improved their performance and proved worthy of promotion. And I believe in any organization, police or otherwise, that that ought to be possible. Having never been perfect myself, I would hope that there would always be the opportunity for improvement. And we've seen it in a lot of people. Some people fall short. Some people can't break the bad habit, and therefore sometimes might end up getting subject to discipline if that breaks the rules or endangers the public. But in other cases,